Hey, everybody, and welcome to Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. I'm Tanner. Before we jump in, we want to thank everyone, as always, for the support for the show. We're happy we're making something that people want to listen to. We hope to continue doing that. So as we've also said previously, we really love interacting on social media. We don't post there probably as much as we should. We're trying to get more consistent with that. But we are on Twitter at @beyond_breakers. We're on Instagram at @beyondthebreakerspodcast. We have an email that's beyondthebreakerspod@gmail.com. And we're also on Patreon. That's patreon.com/beyondthebreakers. We want to keep the show ad-free, but if you think what we do is worth a few bucks, head over to Patreon. You can give us, I think, either $3 or $5, depending on how much you think we've earned from you. So check those out if you're interested in seeing a little bit more from the show. We do post monthly bonus content on the Patreon. So with all that being said, let me bring in my partner in maritime crime here, Taylor. Taylor, what have you been up to?
Not a whole lot. It's good to be back. I know we took last week off because, just kind of needed a break after 6 months straight of releasing episodes, but... it's good to be back. We're getting into the fall season. We were talking before we started. There was some good college football yesterday that we both enjoyed. But, mostly excited to be back doing this.
Yeah, I didn't realize how long we'd been doing it pretty much without a pause until you mentioned that last week that we'd been doing it for that long. So, yeah, definitely needed to have a little week off there. Again, if you're really craving that extra episode this month, check out Patreon. We have a really good one that we made about the scuttling of the German high seas fleet most recently.
Yeah, that was a fun one.
All right. Good stuff. Aside from football, anything interesting you've been consuming, taking in?
There's actually probably not the most fun thing. There's actually a really good 9/11 documentary on Hulu where they kind of go like in 15-minute increments and interview people like from that day. And it was really good, like super detailed. It was a lot of good like human interest stories and just a lot of like unique pictures and video that like I'd never seen from that stuff. And like, I feel like I've seen a lot of it, but I don't know. It's just very interesting. If you're looking for something like that, it's definitely worth your time.
Where, did you say that was on Hulu or Netflix? Where was that?
Yeah, Hulu. There's one on Netflix as well that was pretty good. It's a little more broad. The one on Hulu is very focused as far as like in very small increments of time and everything. And like it's a pretty emotional one. Like it's a rough watch, but it's very interesting.
I'll shelve that one probably for a time when I'm more in the mood for that. But that sounds really fascinating.
Yeah, very interesting, but not exactly the most uplifting story. Although you're listening to a shipwreck podcast, so
yeah, and we have a bad one today.
So yeah, it's not great. We'll get there, but it's not a great one.
Yeah, I guess my thing from this past week, I finally got back into painting. So anyone who follows me on Instagram knows I'm into painting miniatures. A lot of Warhammer type stuff. I finally got back into that. It's been about 2 months since I put paint to model at all. So yeah, it felt good. It's kind of one of those hobbies where when you get out of it, you're very out of it in my experience. And it just seems like the hardest thing in the world to sit back down and work on something that's going to take you, hours, days to finish.
Right.
But when you do, it really benefits you, I think, to have that kind of hobby to sort of focus on something that isn't reading or something that isn't super, super mentally taxing. So that's been cool. That's sort of helped me feel a little bit better this past week, is getting back into that and feeling like I'm not exactly making something, but doing something productive and entertaining with my time.
Nice. Yeah, I can imagine that, like you said, like getting out of that hobby, for a little bit and then getting back into it, it's a little intimidating. I've never done it, but I can't imagine having the patience to spend hours painting a little like 3-inch figure.
You just need a lot of good podcasts.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Right. Something else I think I wanted to mention this. If we had done an episode last week, probably would have made more sense to mention it there. In our most recent episode that we released, we talked about the sinking of the Russian trawler Dalny Vostok. And in that episode, we mentioned the Russian MCS, the Ministry of Emergency Services in Russia. Ministry of Emergency Situations. And literally just a few days after we released that episode, we talked about how that agency had such a cool name. Actually, the head of the ministry, Yevgeny Zinichev, he was actually killed. He was attempting to save the life of a documentary filmmaker who was filming military exercises in Norilsk. So like up above the Arctic Circle, or there were Arctic exercises rather. So the filmmaker was also killed tragically. This is the head of the ministry himself jumping into action to try to save someone.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting that it's not like he wasn't just like a guy. Like, I don't know how often do you see someone who's like a department head like that actually doing, you know, what they're trained to do.
Right. It's probably the most raw example of, well, leading by example, I guess.
I guess also just a good example of like when you're in a dangerous situation, like it's dangerous for everybody. Like, mm-hmm. I think much like being on the ocean, being in the Arctic, like one little mistake can be deadly for multiple people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wanted to mention that since they were kind of a focal point of our last episode.
Did they say what happened, or were you able to find
it? I believe it sounds like the filmmaker or part of the film crew was in a situation where they were going to fall off of a cliff, and Zinichev sort of jumped in to try to restrain them from falling, and I believe they both fell. I believe it was kind of a rocky sort of ravine or cliff side they were falling off of, and so they were both killed. And I believe those were the only two casualties. But yeah, that was a big deal. I mean, he had a relatively storied career in Russian government. He was like many of those people. He was, you know, a KGB guy. A lot of the Western coverage of it is very clear to point out, you know, Yevgeny Zinichev, a close ally of Putin, which I think is funny because I don't know. That seems like kind of a necessary first step to be anyone in the Russian government.
I was about to say, like, I don't think you become in charge of like an agency in Russia without being Putin's pal.
I don't think you can necessarily use that as like a, to try.
Like at least nominally, like you'd have to be like pro Putin, right?
I would assume so. Yeah. I don't know that much about how Russian politics work, but I feel like a lot of the Western coverage of it always had to put in that little caveat. It's like, oh, by the way, he was friends with Putin. It's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I probably would be too if I was in that situation.
Right.
So anyway, that's all about that.
Let's talk about something much happier.
Yes. I wish we had a show about something much happier to talk about. but no, this is really,
what are we talking about today?
This is really fascinating. And I've been really excited to do this episode for a long time. So I'm glad we're finally doing it. We are going to talk about something that is not entirely a boat, nor is it entirely a duck. We are going to talk about duck boats. Have you ever been on a duck boat?
I have not. They've always just seemed a little sketchy to me.
Yeah. Think so? All right. I've never been on a duck boat. I believe Katie has.
I know that, like, when you drive through central Wisconsin, you, like, get beat over the head with billboards that say, ride the ducks at the Dells.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I believe it was at the Dells, I think, is where she would have ridden those. So, yeah, I've never been on a duck boat personally. After this episode, I'm definitely never going on a duck boat.
Yep, no way.
So, first off, let's talk about what is a duck boat? What's the deal with duck boats? All right, so duck boats are like many cool and quirky military things, something that came out of World War II and the subsequent Cold War. They can be traced back to Vannevar Bush. I think I'm saying his name correctly. Vannevar.
That is a very interesting name.
It is. And I know he's a relatively well-known guy in like the science and engineering world. I just have no idea how to say his name. So his team was also partially in development of things like the atomic bomb, the bazooka, a lot of not exactly fun stuff. But
was this dude just sitting around like tinkering like all day? Like, how could I make weapons to kill the Nazis or what?
I guess. From what I read a little bit about the process. It kind of seems like, you know, someone in the military brass has an idea of, well, what if we had a truck that could go in the water too? And that kind of just gets kicked down to send it down to the nerds in the lab and see what they can come up with. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how a lot of these projects took off, was someone had an idea, but no real knowledge of how that idea could be implemented. And then we have this team kind of sit down and try and figure this out. Is this possible? So probably the same type of people, maybe the exact same people who were responsible for those things like the small individually sized atomic like bazooka rounds.
The Davy Crockett.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, those are ridiculous. That's some Fallout stuff right there. That's a fat man.
It is. It literally is.
Anyway, so this idea, this having this army truck that could swim from ship to shore during landings, that was the initial kernel of this idea. So in June 1942, they had developed a prototype. In water, it could go up to 5 miles per hour.
Okay.
On land, it had a top speed of 50 miles per hour. One of the designers of this, when they were looking at the prototype, joked, "She's better in water than any truck, and she'll beat any boat on a highway."
Some good engineer humor there.
So not exactly stellar praise for this thing that they made. It's sort of just acknowledging its shortcomings. It can kind of do both, but it doesn't do either one particularly well.
What? I guess my question is, like, what did this do better than the basic landing craft that we're all familiar with from, like,
so,
D-Day and Saving Private Ryan?
Going to get to that here in just a few seconds. Okay. So Patton employed them for the invasion of Sicily. I think he used around 1,000 of them. So starting in July of 43, these started getting a lot more use. They were also used in the Pacific by the Marines during landing assaults. And to answer your question, they were considered really useful, and a lot of the troops really liked them because they could deliver troops further up the beach than your
troops. So you're not having to like wade through the water, like chest deep water.
Exactly. So they would basically, when they get into the shallows, sort of gun it so they can get as far up the beach as possible, drop people off, and then of course, obviously, turn around and head back. So yeah, I mean, they did have a really considerable advantage over your traditional landing craft. In that sense. So yeah, you could definitely say that they were successful for the job that they were developed for.
Which was to land troops under fire on a beach, not
yes.
Not other things.
Yes, they have a relatively small, concise, clear task they're supposed to accomplish.
You could say that they were designed to do something relatively safely in a very dangerous environment.
Exactly. They're trying to be safe, but not sacrificing efficiency to do that by any means.
Surely nothing bad will happen.
Sounds like a perfect thing to repurpose for civilian use. So overall, GM built 21,000 about of these. 21,147 duck boats were constructed. There are various different designs. Some of them are slightly longer. There is something called a truck duck, which is just a fun name. So of course, World War II ends, and you got all these duck boats sitting around. A lot of them were kind of just left to rot where they were. Because, again, they were kind of designed to be more or less disposable.
Right.
This was not the kind of thing that you were going to build and was supposed to make it through the war or make it through really, really heavy combat. That's not what these were designed for at all. So a lot of them just kind of got left. There's probably tons of them still hanging out in Europe, rusting or in museums or whatever. Some of them did make it back to the United States. And they were first used for recreational and business purposes in 1946 in Milwaukee, actually.
Wow. Yeah. It's like really surprising that that quickly someone's like, hey, I got this old boat sitting here. Like, let's get some tourists in there.
I want to know what other World War II leftovers were used for tourism purposes. I got this.
I do know that like some of the aircraft were used for like airlines afterwards, some of the transport aircraft and stuff.
I've got this old Nebelwerfer lying around, and I have nothing to do with it. Charge people like $5 a pop to shoot the Nebelwerfer.
Also, I do know, like, we'll talk about it, but things like some of the Liberty ships that were repurposed into cargo ships afterwards, and some of the safety issues that come along there, like the Marine Electric, it's a running theme that a lot of this military surplus stuff was not built to last.
And probably not designed to be used by civilians.
It's like you said, this was made for, hey, we drove it up the beach and the invasion's over. Like, it's all shot up. It's time to get a new one. It wasn't made for 30 years of service.
Right. So estimates, this stat comes from a pretty old Smithsonian article from 2002. At that time, they estimated between 300 and 1,000 of them still in the United States. Some of those owned by like private collectors, museums, so not necessarily used for what we're going to talk about in this episode. So somewhere in that range, in the several hundred range.
And I think, you know, that type of ownership makes more sense. If you're like a private owner who's taking it out yourself, it's like the people that restore old World War II airplanes, like you're going to take care of it because you don't have like a profit motive. Like you're just doing it as a hobby. So obviously you want to like take good care of it.
Yeah. And if you've got your like a museum or something, this is a perfect thing to have in a museum. It's a cool relic from that time period.
And they are goofy looking. Like they're so dumb looking. Like it's kind of fun. It looks like something a child would draw.
It does. Yeah. It is just like a boat that they slapped some wheels on. So we talked about the sort of build up of these as a tourism tool. So that kind of took off. And then by like the 90s, it was a relatively popular thing. So yeah, you'll see them. You go to like the Wisconsin Dells, you go to any number of water adjacent places in like Missouri, Arkansas, you can see these. Seattle,
I know,
also
Boston, I think also has them in the harbor.
Yeah, they're pretty
anywhere with like a harbor area, I feel like.
Yeah, they're pretty popular. They're gonna have that. So with all of those different places using duck boats, of course, it's not too long before you start to have incidents. The first incident for which the NTSB has had to actually conduct an investigation and look into it is actually one of the really bad ones. So this happened in Hot Springs, Arkansas in 1999. This was a boat called the Miss Majestic. So this was an excursion tour of Lake Hamilton in Arkansas. So just to run through what happened here quickly, I'm going to quote from the NTSB report. I'm actually quoting from a report that we'll talk about later, referring back to this original accident. Quote, about 7 minutes after entering the lake, the 31-foot-long vessel listed to port and rapidly sank by the stern in 60 feet of water. The operator and most of the 20 passengers were trapped by the vessel's canopy and drawn underwater, except one passenger who escaped before it submerged. As the vessel descended to the bottom of the lake, six passengers and the operator were able to escape, and upon reaching the water's surface, were rescued by recreational boaters in the area.
I couldn't help. The thing that jumped out there to me is canopy. I don't think that they had canopies on them when they were driving up the shores of Iwo Jima and stuff like that.
You got to keep the sun out of your eyes when you're
sleeping. Yeah, like, and that, I think that's a thing right there, right? Like, so these are like super utilitarian Spartan vehicles, but the moment you start doing modifications to make them more passenger friendly, you're actually making them like a literal death trap.
Correct, because we'll keep harking on that theme of these things aren't designed necessarily to stay afloat indefinitely.
Right.
In fact, they're kind of not supposed to be in the water for longer than you need them to be.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. Like, can it float? Sure. But it's like a straight line to the beach. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not meant to just, like, do an excursion mm-hmm. around the bay.
Yeah. So, yeah, that canopy is going to be a main character in a later story here. So, yeah, I mean...
The antagonist.
Just to sort of review that, so you had, I think, 21 total people on this boat. Only one person is able to get off of this boat before it sinks.
That's crazy.
Some of the others survive, but because of this canopy, the way that this thing is designed, only one person makes it off this boat. If you look at a picture of a duck boat from, say, World War II, one of the things you notice, this is an extremely easy craft to exit. It's a landing mm-hmm. craft. You're supposed to be able to get out of this thing very, very easily. And you can, if you can go over the side, you can go over the top. But if that exit is blocked, this thing loses most of its usefulness. So an investigation found that water first entered Miss Majestic via an unsecured clamp in the drive shaft housing on the boat. Once water entered the boat and dragged down the stern, there was no way to prevent the sinking. So we have this, basically a hole left open in the boat. Entering the drive shaft, and that single thing causes this boat to sink. So the boat sinking, as we've said, that's not necessarily a surprise. These things aren't designed right. to be necessarily watertight. But the NTSB found three main safety issues contributing to the loss of life. So yes, it sank, but why did so many people die? First of them was vessel maintenance. So that aforementioned unsecured clamp. And then also the water pump aboard, which we'll talk a little bit more about later with our later story. Another issue was reserve buoyancy. So reserve buoyancy, just as a quick definition, just taking this from the NTSB report. Reserve buoyancy is the internal volume of a vessel that is not flooded or capable of being flooded.
Interesting.
So basically any part of the ship, any mechanism, any compartment, anything that will keep a vessel afloat, even if the hull has been compromised. So any sort of flotation device that is integral to the ship, mm-hmm. some sort of passive buoyancy system, anything that's going to keep the ship afloat would be reserve buoyancy. And this also ties in with things like compartmentalization. On most of our stories, we always talk about things like watertight bulkheads. And right. you talk about, you know, when these big, big passenger liners go down, they're designed in such a way that maybe six of their forward compartments can flood. But, you know, right. if 10 of them flood, okay, now you have a problem. But it's built to withstand a certain amount of flooding in the event of a disaster.
Right.
These don't have that. Again, it's a landing craft. You don't want a bunch of different compartments and stuff dividing this thing up. You want this to be a big open space that you can jump into and jump out of very, very quickly.
Yeah, I think the thing to keep in mind is these have more in common with like a bass fishing boat than mm-hmm. like any of the vessels we've discussed previously. Like, this is not like a complicated piece of machinery.
Yeah, exactly. This is a hunk of metal that has been shaped into a certain form, and it does one job. So yeah, that reserve buoyancy on these is essentially zero. Once water is in this, if the hull is compromised, if it starts to flood, there's nothing you're going to do to keep it afloat. There's nothing else working against that force. And then the final one was survivability. So the design of the canopy on the vessel contributed to the deaths as it prevented quick escape from the boat. So those are the three main factors that will rear up again here. I do want to quote directly from the NTSB here. NTSB, I love the way that they write. I think there's a very clear style that they tend to use. And I think that's on display here. So the NTSB warned, Quote, amphibious vessels are vulnerable to rapid sinking because they lack reserve buoyancy. Consequently, the safety board concludes that the potential exists for another life-threatening accident similar to the sinking of the Miss Majestic, unless the vulnerability to flooding and sinking is addressed.
They're about to look really smart.
Yeah, they're going to look like some wizards here. It's like, really, they're just going to look like kind of common sense, and everyone else is going to look stupid? But, right. Yeah, relative wizards here. Continuing on with this warning and advice, they continue, without delay, alter your amphibious passenger vehicles to provide reserve buoyancy through passive means such as watertight compartmentalization, built-in flotation, or equivalent measures so that they will remain afloat and upright in the event of flooding, even when carrying a full complement of passengers and crew. So, they're not happy with what they find. They find some pretty clear ways that this could have been either prevented or mitigated. So they make these recommendations. And this leads to an interesting example that I don't know that I've seen quite so clearly until now. But it deals with how the NTSB's recommendations are actually implemented. Or in this case, not implemented. So the NTSB basically makes their recommendations, and that's how they're always phrased. So if you read an NTSB report, for anyone who's never read one, at the end of it, it's always listed as recommendations. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily requirements because they don't really have the independent authority to enforce them. They're sort of just saying, hey, this is what we found. This is what you should do. Usually, people do it. So when they investigate a plane crash, and they say, oh, we should have had lights along the floorboards. We should have done this or should have done that. It's usually done because that's the safest thing to do. In this case, it really wasn't. So a lot of these independent tourism places operating these basically failed to do anything with this information, which I think is certainly a choice.
And I would think part of that plays into that airline, you know, operators are billion-dollar industries, mm-hmm. and a lot of this is probably not.
Right.
It's like the stakes aren't as high financially, mm-hmm. and there's just not an organization that's there to compel these businesses to do it.
Yeah, and
because it would probably put some of them out of business because the you know, profit margin's so thin. Whereas Delta and United, money's not even real to them necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for example, like Miss Majestic, the damage. And I'm assuming this includes like cost of refitting it to send it out again, I think was around $100,000. And yeah, like you said, if I'm running a small lake tourism business in Arkansas, I maybe don't have $100,000 to retrofit and make this thing totally in line with regulations.
Right.
So again, very, very few. I think one of the companies they contacted made the recommended changes. So the NTSB followed up by saying, because the industry has by and large refused to take voluntary action to address the risk, the safety board considers it imperative that a regulatory authority take steps to ensure that all amphibious passenger vehicles will not sink in the event of an uncontrolled flooding event. And the Coast Guard on this basically punts. So they did not agree that any sort of regulatory action was needed. They said basically, hey, you told them what to do. They've gotten plenty of advice. We'll just let them do their thing. Again, that's a choice. Always, always trust the business people to do what is safest for everyone. That's what I say. So that was the first incident and one of the more major incidents involving these craft. There's a couple more I'll just list off here. One called the Minnow sank in Milwaukee Harbor in 2000. This wasn't technically the same type of vessel. I didn't really look into it too much, but this was an Alvis Stalwart vessel. So same type of amphibious role, but not exactly the same type of boat. It sank with no fatalities. In Seattle, Washington, in December 2001, a boat called the Duck Number 1. It sank with no fatalities after a missing access plug allowed water into the hull, very similar to what we saw with the Miss Majestic.
I was going to say, that seems to be a theme.
Mm-hmm. Duck 34 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in 2010. It actually collided with a tugboat on the Delaware River, and two passengers were fatally injured. Here we obviously have a different situation that's not necessarily something you could chalk up to the design of the duck boat itself, that theoretically could have happened to any type of boat. Duck number 6 in Seattle, Washington. I believe this was 2015. My notes say 25, but that hasn't happened
yet. I was
going
to say, so are you Nostradamus over here?
We'll have to see. We'll have to revisit this episode in a few years and see what happens. So this one's interesting because we've talked a lot about these boats as boats, but very little as vehicles on land.
Right.
So this one's not technically a boating incident. In this case, a stretch duck, so one of those longer versions of the duck, it was driving down a road and it crossed the center line into oncoming traffic and hit a motor coach.
That's just a bad day.
5 of the coach passengers were killed.
That's like the first road accident we've ever talked about on here.
It is. So that's a first for the show. Congratulations to Duck 6 from Seattle, Washington. And finally, the last big story we'll talk about here in our discussion is Stretch Duck 7, Branson, Missouri, July 19th, 2018. So for people listening to the show, I'd say probably specifically Americans. I don't know if this got coverage outside of the U.S. Americans, very good chance that you remember seeing this on the news. So summer of 2018, we have this duck boat incident in Missouri at Table Rock Lake. You remember this, right?
I do. Like, I actually remember this happening and being pretty interested in it. And the interesting thing here is, like, there's a video of it happening.
Oh, yeah. There's, like, tons of video.
It's a thing. Like, it's a documented thing that you can watch.
Yeah, you can see, like, how fast this happens. And it's pretty crazy. Yeah, this is when I remember it happening. It had been sort of bouncing around in my head. And actually, I think Katie was the one who brought this up as a possible episode topic.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, she's ridden duck boats before. But probably won't again, I'm guessing. I'm hoping.
Not with you, right?
Yeah, not with me. So Stretch Duck 7 was operated by Ride the Ducks Branson, and it gave tour excursions of Table Rock Lake. So these excursions included both a land and water portion. Cool, because it's taking advantage of both parts of the duck boat. So typically, in these, the land portion occurred first. You would do your land tour, and then it would get in the water, and you would do your lake tour. That's right. Normally how it happened. But not on this day. Because heavy weather was expected on the 19th. Which prompted the manager on duty to advise the pilots to flip the order of the tour. So to do the lake portion first and then land. We have this super, super heavy weather coming in. So, hey, do the water stuff first and then come back on land.
But I feel like I also wouldn't want to be driving around, like, in the middle of a major thunderstorm in just a small canopy covered
piece. Right. And I think
that doesn't seem like a better option.
I think the choice here, rather than, hey, we could do them first so you can get the lake out of the way, the better option might just be don't go in the lake.
I think the better option is, here's your $20 back. Here's a rain check for tomorrow.
Yeah, like the first time I read that, it was just, that's the advice. Like, just do the other part first.
Yeah, because it doesn't make any sense to me. Like, doing the land portion in the middle of a major thunderstorm just doesn't sound fun.
With something like weather, like, yes, of course we can predict it, but we get things wrong all the time. Mm-hmm. So timing that out in a matter of, you know, 10, 20 minutes is pretty tight. So about 5 minutes after entering the lake, the Stretch Duck 7 began experiencing heavy winds due to the onset of what was later determined to be a derecho. I think you read a little bit about derechos, right?
Yeah, I did a little derecho research. So, I don't know, like, how familiar people are, like, outside of the Midwest and the South with what a derecho is. It's basically, like, when you just have line after line of, like, these really heavy thunderstorms, they tend to spawn tornadoes, but they also produce, like, straight-line winds. So, a lot of times you're not even sure if you're dealing with a tornado or just, like, you know, 70, 80 mile an hour straight line winds that can do just as much damage, if not more, than a tornado. You tend to get, like, these long paths of tornadoes that'll go through multiple states, depending on how well, like, the derecho is organized. They're pretty scary. Like, I've been through them. Like, I've, you know, living in the Ohio area, they usually get about one a year. So, you know, some are worse than others, but they can be pretty scary because they just don't stop. They go on for hours, or, you know, sometimes they blow right through, but they move very quickly as well. So it'll go from being a nice sunny day to pitch black with tornadoes in the matter of 20 minutes. And I think that's the part that I think is important for our story, is that you do know that it's coming, but you also know that the conditions can deteriorate almost instantly and become very, very deadly.
Yeah, that's a super important part. It's kind of like I think anyone who's dealt with like a tornado situation where you have the tornado watch, and that's not the kind of thing that is really predictable outside of the conditions. And so, yeah, it can deteriorate very, very quickly.
I mean, derechos are the kind of things that there's even not so much now because of weather detection, but in the 50s and 60s, there's a few plane crashes that have been attributed to, you know, sudden, you know, downbursts and things like that caused by derechos. So they're a very serious thing. It's definitely something that I think if you live in the Midwest or the South, like, you're very aware that if that's something that's developing, that, like, you do need to take it seriously and prepare properly for a potential tornado.
Stay away from the lake. Let's see, so about 5 minutes after entering the lake, no, I got to that part already. We talked about the derecho. So this involved wind gusts of up to 73 miles an hour and 3 to 5 foot waves on Table Rock Lake here. And I was thinking about 3 to 5 foot waves because in the context of most of what we discuss, that doesn't sound that bad. If we're talking about like a big ocean liner or like a lake freighter or something.
Right.
That sounds kind of rough, but really not that bad. But then again, looking back at the size of this boat and how low it sits in the water, a 5 foot wave, I mean, that's essentially the size of a person. And this boat should probably not be trying to handle that. So yeah, right. It doesn't sound fun.
No, like, and I've been out in the ocean quite a bit on smaller fishing boats, like a 20 foot boat or something. And it's, you know, a 5 foot wave is, you know, you're looking up at it sometimes when it's, when you're kind of riding the swells and stuff. So yeah, like on a smaller boat, a 5 foot wave is, it's something, it's something to deal with.
Right.
So that would even be in regular weather, in a thunderstorm, even worse.
So another boat, the Stretched Up 54, was able to exit the lake safely. I don't know if they started their tour earlier or at the same time, but they were on the lake and they were able to get off in time.
Nice.
As Stretch Duck 7 was attempting to do the same, she sank in about 250 feet from the ramp. So she's coming back in and she sinks on the way in. And this was in around 85 feet of water. So, I mean, relatively deep, you know, too deep for obviously to be safe if your ship is going down there. So right. Of the 31 people aboard, 17 of them were killed in this incident. We are going to talk about why. Or maybe we already know why if we listened carefully to the NTSB.
I think we have some ideas.
Yeah. So when the ship was salvaged, no hull breach was found. That was fully intact. Nothing, you know, they didn't hit anything. No problems there. And also they didn't find any of those issues we talked about previously where a valve or a plug is left open So that wasn't the case here. The NTSB determined that the canopy and the side curtains were a contributing factor in the fatalities of this accident.
That makes sense.
So we've already talked about the canopy. We talked about that with the Miss Majestic. That was blamed for the deaths in that accident. So here we have the entire passenger and crew space covered by a fixed canopy. So it's basically, if you look at it, it's basically two sections of canopy that sort of fold into the center rod across the top.
Mm-hmm.
So underneath this canopy frame, that's where the life preservers are hanging. So above the heads of the passengers, you've got this, you know, these rows of the life preservers that are strapped onto the frame of the canopy. Sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds like easy access.
In theory, yes. Your life preserver is just above your head, easy to get to. However, as we've talked about these things, in a boat like this with absolutely no reserve buoyancy, if it gets flooded, it's going to sink in, we're talking seconds, not minutes in this case. So yeah, in the event of a sinking, this thing is going to go down very, very quickly. This is going to be more of an impediment because you probably don't have time to unhook it and get it on. It's still going to be there when the ship is dragging you down. So all of that stuff above your head is still going to be there.
Right. It's just more to work through to try to get off the vessel.
Mm-hmm. So post-accident, 56 life jackets were counted. Of those, 41 were still strapped to the canopy frame. So as you can see, that easy access didn't do very much for a lot of the people on the boat because they weren't even able to get them. And that's assuming that they tried. You know, people might not have thought to grab those first. That's a possibility, too. But they weren't able to be put to use. Several survivors recall hitting impediments and being pinned against the canopy before they could break through it to escape upward from the submerged vessel. So being interviewed after the fact, that's what many of them listed as a factor in the wreck, was not being able to get off until they were able to sort of basically rip off this canopy as it was sinking.
Yeah, that's crazy to think that, like, you're trapped. Like, you literally can't get off of this vessel.
Mm-hmm. Again, a vessel that is originally designed to be gotten off of very easily and quickly.
One like thing I want to jump in real quick, a little bit like personal experience, I guess. And you were actually here for this. Do you remember taking that trip from Mackinac Island back to Mackinac City?
Yes.
Do you remember a little adventure where the boat kind of caught a wave the wrong way and tilted at an extremely uncomfortable angle?
Yeah. Do you remember the first episode of our podcast where I said I hate being on ships? Yes.
Yeah. So the reason of kind of telling that story, and honestly, the most scared I've ever been on a vessel, and like I said, I've been out in the ocean plenty of times on a small fishing boat and never really felt in danger. That day, you know, it caught a wave. The boat was already not working properly. And the thing is, when you're a tourist, you're not thinking that you might have to be in a survival situation. It just happens. Mm-hmm. Like, no one's mentally prepared for this. If you're on a cargo vessel and you're in the middle of a storm, you're thinking, like, hey, I've got my life jacket ready. I know where my survival gear is. If you're just on a passenger vessel, like, thinking it's a 20-minute boat ride back from Mackinac Island, you're not in survival mode. Like, it just happens. So in this case, you know, these people aren't thinking, like, oh, I might have to, you know, do something to survive.
Right.
You're just not prepared to do it. Mm-hmm. I think that plays a role in here, too, where you have to be aware, you know, you're not dealing with professional sailors. You're dealing with civilians.
Right. So, kind of continuing on the same vein there, in terms of escapability of this vessel, another thing that contributed here is these curtains. So there's these clear vinyl side curtains on this particular boat. And I say curtains, that's not entirely accurate, because this is one continuous piece of vinyl surrounding the passenger space. Mm-hmm. There's basically one on each side. So there's a starboard side one that wraps all the way around that side, and a port side one that wraps all the way around that side. And these are deployed and retracted by, they're wrapped around like a reel. and they're deployed and retracted by an electric motor that's controlled by the crew or by the captain. So it sort of cranks it all around the boat when they need to be put out.
So not easily, like, manually removed in an emergency?
No, this is not something that you could, like, say, punch out, like, one frame of it or, like, one piece. It's not going to come out easily. You're going to have to cut through this or something, basically. But that is taken into account also. So in an emergency situation, these could, in theory, be separated with a manual release lever.
Mm-hmm.
So this lever sort of just drops that whole mechanism over the side or off. So that rather than having to wait for this thing to, you know, pull back in, which, you know, probably takes a minute or two at least, I'm guessing. The whole thing can sort of be jettisoned. Again, to open that up so people can get off. Now, an interesting thing with the design of this emergency lever, or rather emergency levers. So the port side lever that controlled that side was directly above the captain's seat. He could reach up and grab this and dispense with the curtain in an emergency situation.
Right.
Not so the starboard lever. This one was on a similar or at a similar location on the opposite side. So this is not something that the captain can necessarily reach from where he's sitting. So in a matter of, you know, an emergency situation that takes seconds to develop, he might not be able to get to it.
That is really crazy. Yeah. So he has to walk over to it.
Mm-hmm. Or at least move somehow to reach this thing. So interesting.
Which is probably not easy to do in 70 mile an hour winds and 5 foot seas.
Right. And you've got passengers panicking behind you, all kinds of stuff that would make this difficult to get to. Interestingly enough, in this incident, only the port side curtain was successfully released.
So strange.
The side that the captain was on, or pilot. I don't know if he's technically called a captain. Leaving the starboard side still enclosed as the boat sank. So he's able to get to the one, as we talked about, but not the other. So if you're on the port side of the vessel, you have a probably better chance to get off. If you're on the starboard, good luck getting through the canopy.
So if you're on a duck boat, sit on the port side.
Probably not terrible advice, honestly. That's really good advice. Unless they've probably changed some of these systems. But again, this wasn't that long ago.
And if anything from history shows us is they probably didn't change a whole lot after this.
Yeah, or sit where you can see the starboard lever. only the left side was released. So again, that highlights the issue of having them being independent and having one of them being outside of the reach of the pilot. So we talked about escapability. Let's talk about buoyancy some more. So again, this is kind of like the canopy. This is just an echo of the Miss Majestic incident. So yeah, if you're an NTSB person right now, you're thinking, we told you so. So the duck construction includes very low freeboard and no compartmentalization or subdivision inside the hull. So it's, again, like we said, it's just kind of like a hollowed up piece of metal that floats, and there's your boat. And it rides pretty low in the water. There's very little wiggle room in terms of what this can handle with rough seas.
Right.
Flooding happens easily, very commonly, and extremely quickly. So this is a known issue. This was always an issue with these boats since they were designed. They knew that they would be taking on a considerable amount of water. So rather than trying to find ways to keep it out, which would sort of sacrifice the actual purpose of the vessel, they focused more on ways to get the water out once it entered and to try to at least stay like above a certain threshold of how much water was in the boat. So this was a development of the Higgins pump, which is an interesting little device. It operated by a chain that was connected to the boat's propulsion shaft. So it wasn't independently powered. It just went as the boat went, basically. So it would run at a speed proportional to the propeller. The faster you go, the harder the pump works, because it knows that this ship is going to be taking on water as you go faster.
So it's fully, like, regulated with the engine.
Yeah, from what I could tell, there was no way to independently operate this. If the ship was stationary, the pump wasn't working. If you were the only way to run the pump at full capacity is to go full speed. These were made to operate, however, whether the bilges were wet or dry. So obviously, with a lot of machines, you don't want to run them dry, per se. But here they were designed to handle that. So again, you've got to go pedal to the metal if you want this thing pumping at full capacity. So Higgins pumps, kind of for this reason, they were removed from a lot of the duck boats and replaced by a sea chest and electrical bilge pump system. You can see diagrams of these online. They're beyond my engineering understanding how they work. But this is the system that the Stretch Duck 7 had. These pumps were found to be totally in working order after the boat was salvaged. So, again, no issue there. No issue with the pumps. Survivors did report water coming up from under their feet through the floorboards and also over the starboard railing. The boat developed a starboard list and rapidly sank by the stern.
Interesting. The water coming up through the floorboards is very interesting.
Yeah, so I read in one section of the report saying how most likely with these heavy waves coming over the side, basically once that started happening, again, there's no compartmentalization, nothing is watertight or sealed off here. Once you get a little bit of water, you start to get more and more and more. And that's why the water was coming up from beneath them, basically, because the bottom was already filling with water.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense.
And clearly these pumps are not pumping out enough water. Because, again, they found that they were working, but this is just not the conditions.
The rate of flooding was just too much.
Exactly. So basically, if the boat had been altered to have those subdivided compartments, that probably doesn't save it from sinking necessarily, just because of the design of the ship.
But maybe it buys them more time.
But yeah, it gives you maybe a few more minutes. Remember, they're only, I think, 250 feet from the dock. It maybe gets them closer, or it gets them to land if they have that little bit of increased buoyancy.
Right.
That is basically the story of the Branson duck boat incident in 2018.
It's super interesting.
It's a repeat, basically, of the Miss Majestic, aside from how the water got in the vessel.
There's just a lot of interesting things around these stories about, like, why is this even allowed to happen? Mm-hmm. Like, there's so many, like, we talk about all the time, like, there's so many factors that go to these accidents happening, which, like, you know, lack of regulation in this case, poor decision-making by the owners of even going out in a storm when you know you have a boat that sinks very easily. That just doesn't seem like a good plan. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Branson duck boats today. So again, you can find duck boat tours all over the country, probably, I'm assuming, in other countries too. But in Branson, because of this most recent incident we talked about, they haven't been operating at this lake, again, for obvious reasons. But there's a group called Branson Duck Tours that is attempting to restart this process in Branson. In January of 21, they announced on Facebook a, quote, newer and safer boat tour.
Okay.
This company is not affiliated at all with the Ripley Entertainment, who's the operating the ones that we talked about in 2018. Totally different company.
Okay.
So the owner, and I don't know if I'm saying his name correctly. I don't know if I care in this instance either. Jaredon Brawl, the owner of this company, says, quote, "We think there's a great opportunity to bring tours back in a better and safer way."
So this man saw an incident that killed, what, 17 people?
Yeah.
And now he has an opportunity. Interesting. I it's not for me.
It'll get more interesting here in a second. So the company posted that these new boats that I doubt they developed them. I think probably someone did, and they purchased them. They're called Hydra Terra boats.
Mm-hmm.
According to the company's post, the Hydroterra boats have proven to be, quote, unsinkable by the Coast Guard because of positive buoyancy foam-filled compartments.
I don't think the Coast Guard says that.
I don't think that's a rating on their forms.
Also, like, literally nothing bad has ever happened in maritime history when you call it unsinkable.
With a ship that can't sink.
Yeah.
So, however, on the positive side, you will remember that this is exactly one of the recommendations the NTSB made. This positive buoyancy foam-filled compartment. So separate sealed compartments that have this extra buoyancy, something that none of these other duck boats have had.
Like, they did the thing that was supposed to be done 20 years ago.
Exactly. So we're finally making some progress here. Again, as you pointed out, though, if the Coast Guard calling something unsinkable sounds exaggerated, you would be absolutely correct. No one at the Coast Guard told him this is unsinkable. The article I was reading cut right to a Coast Guard officer saying, "Yeah, we don't do that. We don't rate ships as unsinkable. You know, we can assess their buoyancy, their escapability, their fire resistance, stuff like that, but we would never call a ship unsinkable." Because that's, I mean, you're just daring the universe to smack you around at that point, I think.
Pretty much.
however, the other big issue, arguably the most important issue, the Hydroterra does still have a canopy.
Uh-oh. That's not great.
But it's okay. You know why?
Because it's not going to sink.
Because,
so who cares?
Because according to Jared and Brawl, the canopy would not be an issue because his vessels will not sink.
That is some real, we don't need these lifeboats on the Titanic energy.
Yeah, why would you need a fire alarm in your house? I have no plans to start a fire in my house. I don't know.
I don't love it. I don't love it.
That's great. Yeah, that won't be a problem because they won't sink. So Andrew Duffy, who is a lawyer for some of the 2018 victims.
I think he might be the first person we've mentioned today that I like.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what other stuff he does, but he sounds pretty cool here. He says, "I think Table Rock Lake should never see a duck boat operation again. I think it's insensitive to bring them back soon and basically run duck boats and have people basically riding over the watery graves of 17 wonderful souls."
I think that's a valid criticism.
I would say so. So as a little update to this, the original plan was actually for them to start operations this summer in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
But in June, so just 3 months ago, they announced they would not be ready for tourism operations this year, but are instead planning to push the operation back to March 2022. And I believe the explanation was unexpected delays. That's horrendously vague. Who knows what sort of issues they're having? So yeah,
how do you even get insurance to operate this?
Yeah,
like,
I don't know.
Insurer is being like, sure, this sounds great. There's a lot of questions here.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of stuff going on here. So March 2022, though, for anyone listening, if you want to go to Branson, Missouri, maybe you can ride the ducks. For legal purposes, I am not encouraging you to do that. Regarding the operators, though, of the 2018 incident, let's talk about them. Because mm-hmm. we talked about earlier, several decisions were made here. You can blame the design of the boat, but humans have to take them out on the water.
Right.
The boat doesn't kill anyone. On its own, at least. So let's talk about that. So as of July 16th of this year, 2021, there was a criminal complaint filed by Stone County prosecuting attorney Matt Selby. And these charges come against Scott McKee, the captain. He faces 17 counts of involuntary manslaughter and 12 counts of endangering the welfare of a child.
Not great.
We have Charles Baltzell, the operations supervisor for the duck boat company. He faces 17 counts of involuntary manslaughter.
Also sounds like a bad day.
And Curtis Lanham, the general manager of the company, he faces 17 counts of involuntary manslaughter. So just in terms of some explanation as to why. So again, one of those is the captain of the boat himself. Obviously, he's involved with this. The next one, that operations supervisor, the one who had been on duty, he's the one who told them basically just flip the order of the tour. So telling him, yes, go out on the lake, but just do it in a different way. So it says that Baltzell failed to properly monitor the weather and communicate weather conditions to the boat when he made that decision. And then also because Lanham, the general manager, failed to call off the duck boat ride as severe weather approached. So idea being he's the general manager, he should be making the call here of my company shouldn't be operating this tour in this weather or this weather that we're expecting.
Right. This is probably the first story or episode we've done where when I read through everything, like, it actually makes me angry. Like, these three people in particular, none of this had to happen if any of them decide to do something different.
Yeah, it's frustrating to see something so clearly researched and identified as a problem not being changed. And again, leading to an accident that's even worse than the original one was.
And I mean, to operate something that you already know is unsafe and then do it in an unsafe manner, it would be, you know, it's kind of like if you're operating like a skydiving school, like the thing you're doing is already a dangerous activity. You need to make sure that you're checking everything and doing everything properly. So the fact that these three aren't able to figure that out, like, I'm not a big prison guy, but, like, enjoy your time. You deserve it.
This was the most recent update I could find of the story in terms of, like, the legal aspects of it. So it'll be something to keep an eye on. We'll definitely, whenever something new comes up, we'll definitely update on that.
Yeah, I would definitely like to keep our thumb on this one and just kind of see what's going on. But yeah, it's rare that you read a story that just angers you, but the fact that it just didn't have to happen.
Yeah, it's, well,
is pretty crazy.
Because a lot of the ones where we see where you could, like, chalk it up to human error, a lot of times, you know, it's in the design of the ship or something that sort of doesn't come into play for quite some time. But here it is. It's much more of a direct decision to do something that's unsafe.
I think even, you know, even go back to, like, the Alfaro. The captain makes the wrong decision, but he's a sea captain on a cargo vessel. He's trying to, you know, he's doing the things sea captains have done since there's been sea captains, and you don't get to that point by being, you know, timid.
Yeah.
This person had children on board his vessel and chose to take them out in a derecho. Like, no sympathy here. None.
Yeah, and I mean, even back to the El Faro, you've got a situation where it legitimately is carrying important stuff that needs to get to where it's going. So regardless of the decision made, you could at least understand the urgency behind this. You know, this is a duck boat tour on a lake.
Yeah, this doesn't have to happen.
So what if this gets canceled?
Everyone gets their refund and they go about their day.
Yeah, I don't know.
But yeah, it's a frustrating one. It was like I said, like one of the only ones I've ever read that, like, I was actually angry, like, sitting here reading some of this stuff.
And yeah, I would say this is also one of the only ones we've done where there's some sort of actionable finding, I guess, for myself. You know, I'm never going to be on an oil tanker during World War II, and I'm probably never going to be on a lake freighter, I'm assuming. But yeah, I can definitely make the decision to get on or not get on a duck boat, and I think I know which one I would choose.
Yeah, at this point, I would have to say for myself and anyone that I care about, don't get on a duck boat. Don't do it. It's just one thing I don't get either is, like, these operators that are doing it, like, you could have, like, a truck pull a trailer and then get on a regular boat, and it would take 30 seconds to do that transition. Like, I don't understand what the duck boat adds to the thing. You know what I mean?
I think you could
still just do it.
I think a lot of it's probably the appeal of, you know, this is a World War II relic. Like, this thing was built in 1944, and you can ride in a landing craft just like they used on Okinawa. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess that probably does have some appeal. That makes sense. But yeah, we are an anti-duck boat podcast.
Yeah.
If the big duck boat lobby comes for us, you'll know what happened.
Yeah, we'll be protesting outside the reopening of the duck boats in Branson.
But actually, since all these duck boat people will be in prison soon, it shouldn't be much of an issue. So,
well, yeah. We'll have to wait on this new guy with his unsinkable boats and see what happens.
Yeah, we like just like preemptively be like, no, nope.
I'm gonna go on Buzzsprout and just schedule an episode to release in like 2 years that's titled
Duck Boats 2.
Duck Boats Part 2. You know.
It's not funny, but you kind of have to laugh at it.
Yeah. Anyway, that's what we've got for today. That's our story. One of our more recent ones, one of our more frustrating stories, but at least here we do know exactly what happened and why.
And hopefully how to stop it from happening again.
Yes, exactly. So, with that being said, stay away from duck boats. Really just,
and I mean, keep listening to us.
Stay on land really as much as possible, I guess, is the best advice. Bad things.
Yes, our
bad things can happen to you on land also, but you know, it's fine. All right, that's it. So if you have nothing else, I'll just say take care, everyone. Have a nice week, and we'll be back next week as usual with some more content for you.